Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now a bloke in a basement on the road in Atlanta, Georgia, and in my friend's basement, which has very poor audio quality, as you can hear the echo. I apologize for that, but I must move on. Our chapter that we're going to do this audio is Exodus chapter 12, verses 1 through 28, the first part of the chapter. It's the institution of the first Passover. Our context is this. In chapter 11, God has threatened, through Moses and Aaron, one last plague. They didn't listen, and so Moses says, I'm out of here, and Moses heads back to Goshen. The last plague, of course, being the destruction of the firstborn. And so now we begin in Exodus chapter 12, 1 and 2. Now the Lord said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, this month shall be the beginning of months for you. It is to be the first month of the year to you. Now the now there indicates a time. When did God say to Moses and Aaron that the first month should be the beginning of months for you? Well, it was before the slaying of the firstborn, obviously, and John Gill says it was even further back than that, probably even before the 3 days of darkness, the ninth plague. It was probably on the first day of the month, John Gill says. I don't know how he knows that. John Gill knows a lot of stuff. I don't know how he knows it. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that whenever it was obviously spoken before the 10th of the month because the Israelites had to prepare the lamb, the sacrifice, the sacrificial lamb, the Passover lamb, by the 10th of the month, and so they had to have time to prepare. So somewhere in advance of Passover, God says, this month is going to be the beginning of months for you. Now, if that's the case, that God said that to Moses and Aaron before the actual sacrifice, it would be now the Lord had said to Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt. The past perfect there not being so clear in the Hebrew, apparently. So we go now to the idea of this month shall be the beginning of months. The name of that month, the Canaanite name was Abib. The Babylonian name is Nisan. That's the name we're most familiar with. The modern equivalent of that is March and April in the Julian calendar. It is to be the beginning of months for the Israelites. The NIV says the first months, not only in order, by count order, but also in estimation, it's the first month. We're going to honor this month as the first month in our esteem, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. This verse right here is the inauguration of Israel's religious calendar. The civil calendar existed side by side with the religious calendar until after the exile, 586 BC. The first month of the civil calendar was Tishri, which was in existence even at this time, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. That's in September or October. But now the religious year is going to start with Nisan in March or April. Now, the religious calendar, the one that starts in Nisan, March or April, that dominated the civil calendar all the way through the monarchy, the Jewish monarchy. And in fact, today, even after the Jewish monarchy has been long gone, the Jews today still use only the religious calendar. So the civil calendar is kind of obsolete now. Why was the first month to be marked out so specially here in Exodus 1 and 2? The NIV Study Bible says it's to remind Israel that her life as a nation started with a supernatural deliverance. John Gill points out it's notable that Jesus' death and resurrection also happened in this month, the month of Nisan. It's not surprising. Jesus is the fulfillment of the Passover rite. So we go now to Exodus 12, verses 3 through 6. Speak to all the congregation of Israel. This is God telling Aaron and Moses. Speak to all the congregation of Israel, saying, on the 10th of this month, they are each one to take a lamb for themselves according to their father's households, a lamb for each household. Now, if the household is too small for a lamb, then he and his neighbor nearest to his house are to take one according to the number of persons in them, according to what each man should eat. You are to divide the lamb. Your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. You shall keep it until the 14th day of the same month. That's Nisan 14. Then the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel is to kill it at twilight. So in verse 3, the Israelites are told they're supposed to take a lamb on the 10th month, prepare it. This was so that every family would have a lamb ready by the 14th, Passover day. Now, it would not be easy to have a lamb ready in the midst of the preparation to leave on the Exodus. Remember, the Israelites are packing up all their belongings, never to come back, heading out across the desert in the famous Exodus, and so they've got a lot on their minds. And so God gave them a few more days to prepare, because in later times, Jews began preparation of the Passover on the 13th day, according to Adam Clark. But here, it's the 10th day, because of the circumstances of the first Passover, they started early on the 10th. Now, it really is remarkable that Israelites would take time for religious observance at this time. They're getting ready to flee slavery from this nasty Pharaoh, and they're gonna have a religious sacrifice. Well, I thought of a nice application point there. How about Christians who are too busy to do anything? Well, how busy were these people? They were getting ready to flee slavery. Always that's the excuse. I'm too busy. I can't read my Bible. I'm too busy. I can't pray. I'm too busy. It never occurs to these worldly Christians that if they would devote their time and heart and energy to first things first, to the gospel, to the kingdom, God will supernaturally and providentially provide time as well as money so that you can do what you need to do to get through in this life. Now, this was a notable day, the 10th of Nisan in subsequent Jewish history, because the Israelites, after the Exodus, after the wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, they passed into the promised land. And we read in Joshua 4:19 this, "Now the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th of the first month," the 10th of Nisan, "camped at Gilgal on the eastern edge of Jericho." So that was the date of their entry into the promised land. So 10th Nisan is a nice date to remember. Now this Passover lamb that was to be sacrificed in verse 3, and of course, and it's nice, it's neat, the logistics of it. If the house is too small, they would bundle the households up and get a lamb to feed more than one house. So they worked it out so that everybody had just the right amount of lamb. Now, this lamb is a type of Christ. We read in 1 Corinthians 5:7, "Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ our Passover has also been sacrificed." Christ our Passover. So the typology there is quite obvious. Christ is the Passover lamb. We'll see later on the blood is going to be put on the lintels and the doorpost. That keeps the angel of death from killing those that are in the house. Therefore, the blood covers them and saves them from death, just as Jesus' blood covers us and saves us from death. Now, this lamb was said to be unblemished in verse 5, just as Christ was perfect. Hebrews 7:26 says this, "For it was fitting for us to have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, innocent and undefiled, separate from sinners and exalted above the heavens." That would be Jesus, our high priest. 1 Peter 1:19 says, "We were redeemed not with precious blood, as of a lamb unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ." Now, Peter, of course, is referring back to the Old Testament Levitical rituals, which required, and also the Passover ritual, which is before the Levitical ritual. These rituals required unblemished and spotless lambs, and the Passover lamb was unblemished and spotless. So the symbolism is obvious. The Passover lamb was perfect, and Jesus Christ, our Passover, he's also perfect. Now, this lamb in verse 5 is to be a year old. The lamb would be in the prime of its youth, just as Jesus was when he was sacrificed on the cross. He was in the prime of his youth. Now, this lamb that was sacrificed can either be a kid, a young goat, or a lamb. This is the NIV note, says this, so does Adam Clark. Kid is the young of a goat, a lamb is the young of a sheep. Now, if we go back and read this, it is a little bit confusing. And here's the NASB in the English, verse 5. "Your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats." Why are you going to take lamb from the goat? Well, the Hebrew apparently for lamb is the young of a lamb or a goat. So if in real clumsy English, you would read like this, "Your young lamb or your young goat shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats." So it's interesting because you don't often think of a Passover goat. The Hebrews preferred lamb, and so that's how it's in our consciousness. But actually, the law allowed for a goat in case a lamb was not available. Now, this is the 14th of Nisan when the Passover was prepared. Now, the fact that the Jews started their days at sunset has created a huge controversy on whether Jesus was killed on the 14th or the 15th of Nisan in order to fulfill the Passover. If the preparation for the Passover was done on the 14th and they ate that and then night fell, which would flip you over to the 15th, that would be Thursday night, and then Friday morning at 12 o'clock, it would be Friday morning. Well, that would be the 15th of Nisan. So they would be preparing the Passover on the 14th, eating the Passover on the 15th, which is Thursday night, and then Friday morning, which is still 15th Nisan, Jesus would be executed. Now, I'm not going to get into all that. If you want 2 PhDs in New Testament theology, you can do this and study the chronological problem. I even saw on the internet a professor from Cambridge said that there was another calendar in use. So there was the religious calendar and the civil calendar, and then there was a third calendar, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke used one calendar, and John used another calendar, and on it goes. It's over my head. I don't care, and I'm sure you don't either. But just for the sake of my sanity, the way I'm going to handle this is to say that Jesus was killed on Friday the 15th of Nisan. They ate the Passover on Friday, early Thursday evening, which was the 15th of Nisan, and the preparation was done on the 14th of Nisan, which was Thursday. Now, this lamb was supposed to be killed in all the households at twilight. Now, the Hebrew literally means between the two evenings, and unfortunately, it's fuzzy as to exactly what that means. It's ambiguous. The NIV Study Bible says twilight could mean between the decline of the sun and the sunset. In other words, the sun goes down over the horizon, but you can still have light everywhere, and then all of a sudden, the sun has disappeared, and then now that you're in that, or it could be between that stage, the sun's already set, you can't see the sun anymore, but there's still daylight, and then all of a sudden the daylight goes away as the sun sinks down further below the horizon. So it could be something like that. And another problem is John Gill says sunset could be any time afternoon. So all of this ambiguity has given rise to all sorts of Jewish controversies over when Passover starts, as well as when the other holy day starts. I don't care. I just pointed out to you to show that it's not as precise as we'd like. We go now to verse 7, Exodus 12. God is continuing to talk to Moses and Aaron, telling Moses and Aaron what the Hebrews are to do. Moreover, they shall take some of the blood and put it on the two doorposts and on the lintel of the houses in which they eat it. Now, the blood was a sign to stop the destroying angel that God's going to send over the land of Egypt, so that the destroying angel of death would not kill the Israelites in their homes. And of course, this is the famous symbol of Christ's blood, which delivers us from death. Now, that symbol is used often in the New Testament. Let me read you four scriptures. 1 Peter 1, 2. According to the foreknowledge of God the Father, by the sanctifying work of the Spirit, to obey Jesus Christ and be sprinkled with his blood. In the Passover ceremony, as we'll see in a minute, the Hebrews would take hyssop, dip it into a bowl of blood, the lamb's blood that was bled into the bowl, and then they would sprinkle that blood on the doorpost and on the lintel at the top of the doorway, and that would save them from death. And so that metaphor is used in the New Testament. Peter says, we're sprinkled with his blood. We're saved from death. Hebrews 12, 24, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood, which speaks better than the blood of Abel, the sprinkled blood, referring to the Passover. Hebrews 10, 29, how much severe punishment do you think he will deserve who has trampled underfoot the Son of God and has regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has insulted the Spirit of grace? Where the blood is not sprinkled, it's just the blood is mentioned, but that's again referring to the blood that Jesus, that the Passover lamb, that Christ our Passover has sacrificed for us, has shed for us. 1 John 1, 7, but if we walk in the light as he himself is in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his son, cleanses us from all sin. I remember when I was young, my mother said, religion without blood is worthless. And I remember thinking, what is the deal, Mama? Come on, what difference does it make? Oh, it makes a big difference, folks, because life is in the blood, and life has to be given for life. Our life is owed to God because of our sin, so somebody's life has got to pay for that, and that life was Jesus' life, and it was symbolized, typified by animal sacrifices in which blood was shed. Very important. Now, this idea of the sprinkling of blood was carried out farther in the Mosaic Law. Hebrews 9:13 says this, for if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh. There was more sprinkling besides the doorpost and the Passover in the Levitical Law, as we'll see. There were several rituals where blood was sprinkled on the people. Hebrews 9:22, and according to the law, one may almost say, all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Blood, 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 everywhere in the New Testament, there's blood, the blood of Christ. And of course, who is it that denies the blood of Christ? Liberals, who are high-class blasphemers, overeducated blasphemers. Now, in verse 7, the Israelites are told to put the blood on the two doorposts. That's going to be done with hyssop, as we'll see when we get down to verse 22. And it says that's going to be done on the houses in which they eat. Now, Jameson Fawcett Brown says the majority of Israelites lived in tents rather than fixed houses. I don't know how he knows that or why he says that, because this whole ceremony is talking about houses, doorpost, and lintel. We go now to verses 8 and 9 of Exodus 12. They shall eat the flesh that same night, roasted with fire, and they shall eat it with unleavened bread and bitter herbs. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled at all with water. This is again God telling Aaron and Moses to give instructions to the Hebrews. Don't eat any of it raw or boiled at all with water, but rather roasted with fire, both its head and its legs, along with its entrails. Now, why did it need to be roasted? I've got six possibilities as to why. First possibility, to make it taste good. I like that. That's John Gill's idea. Roast the Passover lamb to make it taste good. Well, frankly, I don't think that's why they told him, that God told him to roast it. But it's true. I lived in northwestern China for about a year or so, and they ate roast lamb all the time, and I ate it all the time. And boy, oh boy, is it good. When I moved out to the east of China in Wenzhou, China, I found a food market, a food court that sold roast lamb from the northwest of China, and I went there constantly to eat that roast lamb. It's delicious. But that's not why God said to roast it, I don't think. John Gill has another idea, to make sure that the lamb would not be broken. We're going to see here later, this Passover lamb had to be in one piece with no bones broken, because Jesus is going to be sacrificed as a Passover lamb, and his bones were not to be broken. And if you roast the lamb, his bones are not likely going to be broken. But you have to cut up the lamb and put him in a pot, and you're going to break a bone. So that's the second reason why, a possible reason why the lamb had to be roasted. The third possible reason is possible, this is my idea, because the later sacrifices in the Levitical law, they were supposed to be burnt, and it makes good symbolism if we have the Passover lamb being burnt also. Fourth possible reason the lamb had to be roasted is because, this is from John Gill, is because the roasting of a lamb is more symbolic of Christ on the cross than a lamb being boiled in water, because a lamb had to be suspended on a hook over a fire to be roasted, and that looks like Jesus hanging on a cross. Interesting idea. Fifth possible reason why the lamb had to be roasted was to oppose the customs of the Egyptians. This is from Adam Clark. The Egyptians often ate raw flesh in honor of Osiris, and God is telling the Israelites, no, you're not going to do anything like the Egyptians. You're going to roast. You're not going to eat raw flesh. And another reason, which I don't have in my notes here, just occurred to me, if you eat something raw and not roasted, there's more chance you're going to get blood. You're going to eat blood. And of course, life is in the blood. Blood was always kept separate and holy in the law. And we don't want to have that. We don't want to have you eating blood. Sixth possible reason for the requirement that the lamb be roasted is roasting is faster than boiling. And again, they were in a big hurry to leave as they were preparing to leave on the Exodus, and time was at a premium. So at any rate, for whatever reason it was, the lamb had to be roasted. It had to be eaten with unleavened bread. Now, why unleavened bread? Unleavened bread reflects the haste with which the Israelites left Egypt, as the NIV Study Bible says. This is easy to point out, easy to prove. Let's look at Exodus 12, verse 11, which we're coming up here shortly. Now you shall eat it in this manner, with your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. So if you took the time to bake bread and wait for it to rise, to leaven it and wait for it to rise, that takes too long. But if you eat it unleavened, that's a perfect symbol of, my gosh, you ate your bread before it rose. Nobody eats bread unleavened. Yeah. But we're in a hurry. We got to get out of Egypt. Exodus 12:39, they baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread. This is where they obeyed Moses' command here. For it had not become leavened since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. This was later codified in the law, Deuteronomy 16:3. You shall not eat leavened bread with it 7 days. You shall eat it with unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, so that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. So the unleavened bread signifies the haste in which the Israelites left Egypt. Now, it's easy to forget that imagery because in the New Testament, Paul and Jesus used the imagery of unleavened bread in a different fashion. They use it to symbolize purity, the lack of sin. Leaven is sin. If you have bread with no leaven in it, that means it's like a person with no sin in his life. We read here in 1 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8, your boasting is not good, Paul says to the Corinthians. Do you not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough? Clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ, our Passover also has been sacrificed. Therefore, let us celebrate the feast not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So Paul takes the very fact of the unleavened bread in the Passover feast, and he makes an application that is different than the original Passover was talking about, was signifying. Paul takes it and switches it from a metaphor meaning haste to a metaphor meaning sin. or unleavened bread would be haste, and unleavened bread would be purity, actually, in the New Testament. Jesus also did the same thing, Luke chapter 12, verse 1. Under these circumstances, after so many thousands of people had gathered together that they were stepping on one another, he began saying to his disciples, first of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. So the metaphor has many uses. We need to keep them straight. God tells the Israelites here in this, in verse 8, Exodus 12, that they are to eat the Passover lamb with bitter herbs. Now, there were bitter herbs in Egypt, indigenous to Egypt, endive, chicory, other bitter herbs available. The point of eating them with the meal is to recall the bitter years of servitude in Egypt, as the NIV Study Bible says. Now, the lamb was to be eaten raw. I just mentioned this already before. It was eaten raw so that blood would, it could not be eaten raw, so that blood could not be eaten. This is a foreshadowing of the law, of course, and this was also a caveat against idolatrous practices because the Egyptians liked to eat raw meat, apparently, in their sacrifices. Now, the lamb was to be roasted whole with the entrails intact. Here's some options as to why the entrails were burnt. Option number one, the heathens used entrails for divination, and we're not going to have entrails around so that anybody would be tempted to use divination. We're going to burn them up. No divination going to be used with the Passover lamb. Well, that's an idea, but I don't think that's what it is. I think the idea of why the entrails were to be burnt was to make sure that the lamb was roasted whole, because if you take the entrails out of a lamb, you can break a bone very easily, getting the guts out. And we know that Christ our Passover was sacrificed without a bone being broken, John 19:36. For these things came to pass to fulfill the scripture, not a bone of him shall be broken. And John, of course, is quoting Exodus 12:46. Which is in this chapter. It is to be eaten in a single house, the Passover is. You are not to bring forth any of the flesh outside of the house, nor are you to break any bone of it. And if you roast the lamb with all the entrails in it, you're not going to break any bone. It's just easier not to break the bone. We also see this in Numbers 9:12, when the law was established. They shall leave none of it until morning, nor break a bone of it. According to all the statute of the Passover, they shall observe it. We go now to Exodus 12, verse 10. And this is God continued to tell Aaron and Moses to instruct the Hebrews. And you shall not leave any of it over until morning, but whatever is left of it until morning, you shall burn with fire. No leftovers. I love leftovers, but no leftovers for the Passover meal. Here's some options as to why. The leftovers might be used for non-sacred purposes, John Gill suggests. For example, people might start worshiping the remains. Superstitious uses, Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown both say, I don't know what they are, I'm speculating, what are they going to do, start worshiping the remains of a sacrificed lamb? I don't know. To me, most probably, it would be used for non-sacred purposes, such as eating, because leftover roast mutton, that would be good to eat, and it would kind of take away from the holiness and the separateness of the ritual. All right, that's option number one. Keep it holy. Don't let the lamb be used for non-sacred purposes, therefore it had to be all burnt up by the night before the night was over. Option number two, so the Israelites wouldn't be burdened with carrying remains on the journey. It'd be a lot of trouble, so burn it up. Don't carry meat. They didn't have refrigerators or coolers on the journey either, so just burn it up so you won't have to carry the lamb with you on the journey. John Gill mentions that. John Gill suggests a third reason why they were not to leave any of it till morning. The Egyptians couldn't desecrate the sacrifice if it was all gone. I can imagine if the lamb was left over and the Egyptians come in and see the Hebrews gone and they see the lamb sitting there in the house, they could, spit on it maybe? Urinate on it? I don't know. They could desecrate the sacrifice. They can't do it if it's burnt up. Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown suggest a fourth reason why they were not to leave any lamb until the morning is to prevent putrefaction. Now, Jesus, of course, did not undergo decay, and therefore the Passover lamb should not undergo decay. Psalm 16:10 says this, you will not abandon my soul to Sheol. This is God speaking to David as a type of Christ. God will not abandon my soul to Sheol, my David's soul to Sheol, nor will you allow your Holy One to undergo decay. That, of course, was a messianic psalm talking about Jesus. Acts 2:27 is quoted by Peter, because you will not abandon my soul to Hades, nor allow your Holy One to undergo decay. Peter is trying to say Jesus' body's not there. He rose again from the dead. He didn't decay as most bodies do. And so we don't want to have a decayed lamb representing an undecayed Jesus. We go now to Exodus 12:11. Now you shall eat it in this matter, with your loins girded, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. And you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. Well, first of all, the name Passover, where does that come from? The angel of death passed over the Israelites, and therefore that's what we have, Passover. Sometimes you hear the word so much you don't think about the origin, but that's where the name came from. Why were they supposed to wear sandals? Sandals usually weren't worn at feast. They were put off to have your feet washed. But at the first Passover, they had to eat and run, if you'll excuse the expression. So they wore sandals, again, to show the haste that they had to go with. The loins girded, that also shows haste. The NIV says, they ate with your cloak tucked into your belt. They were to eat with your cloak tucked into your belt, loins girded. That's symbolic for a hasty departure. It's not only symbolic, it's actually useful for a hasty departure, because if you've already got your clothes ready to go, you can eat and run. You can get up and go. Now, all of these injunctions about the sandals, wearing sandals and having your loins girded, your cloak tucked into your belt and all, those were only observed at the first Passover, as James and Fawcett Brown point out. Subsequent Passovers did not require that. We go now to Exodus 12:12. For I will go through the land of Egypt on that night and will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt. This is God continuing to talk to Moses and Aaron, telling Moses and Aaron what God is going to do. I will strike down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgments. I am the Lord. Now, God has already executed judgments on every one of the gods of Egypt. Many of the gods of Egypt. Now, I found a table of the Egyptian gods who were judged in the 10 plagues on the Zondervan Academic webpage, and I thought this was good to go through. The first plague was the turning of the Nile to blood. That judged Hapi, also called Apis, the bull god, because he was the god of the Nile. It judged Isis, because she was the goddess of the Nile. It judged Khnum, the ram god, because Khnum was the guardian of the Nile, and there are others also. The frog plague, the second plague, that judged Heket, who was the goddess of birth. Heket had a frog head. Third plague, gnats, that judged Set, who was the god of the desert storms. I'm not exactly sure what gnats has to do with desert storms. I guess because the gnats came out of the sand. Fourth plague is the plague of flies. Of course, the fly is dark of the sun. That judged Ray, the sun god, Widget, U-A-T-C-H-I-T. It's hard to pronounce that god, Widget, possibly represented by the fly. So that god was judged. The fifth plague was the death of livestock. Hathor was a famous Egyptian goddess with a cow head, judged. Apis, the famous Egyptian bull god, he was judged too. Apis was the symbol of fertility, judged. The boils that broke out, that showed judgment on Sekhmet, the goddess with power over disease. Judgment on Sunu, the pestilence god. Judgment over Isis, the healing goddess. The seventh plague is hail. That judged Nut, the sky goddess. That's one of the original gods of Egypt, very famous. Hail came down from the sky, and Nut couldn't stop it. Osiris, the god of crops and fertility, the hail smashed the crops. Set, god of the desert storms. I don't know what hail has to do with that, but this Zondervan table says so, so I'll take their word for it. I'll have to think about that. Locust, that's the eighth plague. The locust judged Nut, the sky goddess, because the locust came out of the sky and Nut couldn't stop it. Osiris was the god of the crops and fertility. The locust ate up the crops. The ninth plague was darkness. Of course, that judged the famous Re, the sun god. Horus was also a sun god, Horus. Nut was the sky goddess. The sky was black. Hathor was a sky goddess. That was black. And now the death of the firstborn, the 10th plague, that judged Min, the god of reproduction. That's M-I-N. I guess I'm pronouncing that right. Men, maybe. Heket, goddess who attended women at childbirth. We've already mentioned him, the frog goddess. Some goddess can't even protect the firstborn. They're all dead. Isis was a goddess who protected children. Children died. Pharaoh's firstborn son was considered a god in Egyptian mythology. He's dead. But there were other gods, too, probably to be judged. And we read here in our verse that we're looking at here, Exodus 12:12, God says, I will judge against all the gods of Egypt. Against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgments. What about the rest of the gods that weren't mentioned in this table that I just mentioned? Well, whatever god that might be left over, they were powerless to deliver from the impending slaughter, as the NIV Study Bible says. The NIV Study Bible and Adam Clark also add that many animals who were sacrificed to the gods, they would be slaughtered. So the gods are helpless, and the sacrifices that are given to the gods are slaughtered and not offered anymore, because many of these sacrificial animals were firstborn animals. Now, here's an interesting note. Execute judgment on all the gods. We're just assuming gods are Egyptian gods here, but actually Some people translate those gods there as rules or principles. You are gods. You know, I forgot the verses, but in the Old Testament and other places, Jesus quoted at one time, the rulers are called little g gods. Gill and Clark and Jameson Foster Brown in the KJV margin actually has the translation as rulers or princes rather than Egyptian gods. Rulers or princes. So that would mean that God is executing judgment on the rulers or princes of Egypt. But as Adam Clark points out, there's a problem with that because these judgments that fell on Egypt fell on everybody equally, not just princes. At the time that this verse was spoken, the 10th plague had not fallen yet. And so when the 10th plague comes, the firstborn is going to die. It wasn't just princes, the rulers, the little g gods. It wasn't them who had their firstborn killed. It wasn't just them, wasn't merely them. All the people of Egypt had their firstborn killed. Poor as well as rich and powerful. Well, you could say Moses is referring to the ruler's kids because it's more tragic and interesting when the mighty fall. Maybe so, but we won't go on the margin. We'll just say it's the Egyptian gods who would judge, not the Egyptian rulers. We go down to Exodus 12:13. God is continuing to speak to Aaron and Moses. The blood shall be a sign for you on the houses where you live, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. There's that term, pass over. And no plague will befall you, destroy you when I strike the land of Egypt. Saved by the blood, the Egyptians will be. Exodus 12:14. Now this day will be a memorial to you, and you shall celebrate it as a feast to the Lord. Throughout your generations, you are to celebrate it as a permanent ordinance. A memorial is something to make the Israelites remember. This momentous occasion. It's going to be a permanent ordinance, as the NIV Study Bible says. Jews to this day celebrate the Passover. I remember when my wife was dating a Jewish guy before I stole her away from him. She would go to Seder's, Jewish Passover feast, and she would tell me all of the stuff they did in these Seder's. And in fact, you have Seder's reenacted in Christian churches a lot. I've seen it over the years. Passover's still around. Now, of course, the Jewish Passover was transformed to the Christian's Lord's Supper because Jesus' last Passover was the first communion, the first Lord's Supper. So now it really is a permanent ordinance till the end of time, if you include the Christian Lord's Supper in it. Adam Clark says, quote, "This, therefore, is a statute and ordinance that can have no end either in this world or in the world to come." That's putting a punctuation on it. And of course, permanent ordinance, it really means as long as Israel exists. If Israel doesn't exist, of course, it can't be an ordinance then. I mean, in 586 BC, Israel got wiped out. So there's no more Passover. So it's permanent as long as Israel exists, it's permanent. Doesn't mean it's throughout all time with no times of exception. Exodus 12, verse 15, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. Now we're going to the Feast of the Unleavened Bread, which is 7 days after Passover, contiguous to Passover. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, God continues to instruct Moses and Aaron. But on the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats anything leavened from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. Now, what 7 days? Again, these days can be confusing. John Gill says it's from the evening of the 14th day to the evening of the 21st. Of course, the evening of the 14th day is the 15th day because Jewish days begin at sunset. So here would be the 7 days. Not including the 14th. 14th is Passover, and then the preparation of the Passover. Actually, in the 15th, at night, they eat the Passover. So I'm going to count on 15th, number one, Nisan the 16th, number two, Nisan the 17th, number three, Nisan the 18th, number four, Nisan the 19th, number five, Nisan the 20th, number six, and Nisan the 21st, number seven. So Nisan 15th and Nisan 21st are the first and the last days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and those days will be holy days in which they shall not do laborious work. Now, during those 7 days, the Israelites were to remove leaven. Again, the leaven is a symbol of the haste in which the Israelites left. They had no time to leaven bread. And later on, it was used as a symbol of sin. As I've already said, today, observant Jews search their homes diligently, often symbolically, but they go through this ritual of looking for every crumb of unleavened bread in the house. Adam Clark says that, quote, "If even a mouse was seen to run across the floor with a crumb of bread in its mouth, they considered the whole house as polluted and began their purification afresh." Now, this Feast of Unleavened Bread is a distinct festival from the Passover. However, because it was so closely related to the Passover in the New Testament, sometimes people would say the Passover referring to the whole 8 days, referring to the Passover feast proper plus the Feast of Unleavened Bread. but they would just say Passover for short. Sometimes they'd say the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and they would include the Passover, the whole 8 days. You need to remember that when you're reading the New Testament. Now, this Feast of Unleavened Bread is mentioned in Exodus 12:39, our chapter, next audio. They baked the dough which they had brought out of Egypt into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. So you see there, the unleavened bread refers to the haste in which they departed. This was codified in the law, Deuteronomy 16:3. You shall not eat leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat it with unleavened bread. That's the 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste. And so Deuteronomy mentions that haste has to do with that unleavened bread. So that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. Now, if you did eat leavened bread during these 7 days, you were cut off. Two options as to what that means. It could either mean you were cut off from the land of Israel, by banishment. You were exiled. Or cut off could mean you were killed. Now, if you were killed, and I tend to believe that cut off means to die, to get killed. That could be legal execution by the Jewish authorities, or it could just mean you die a premature death from natural causes. God does it instead of the legal authorities, or it could mean eternal death. You go to hell, you live a natural life, but when you die, you go to hell forever because you ate leavened bread. I really don't think so. Or it could mean a violent death that God providentially arranges a rock to fall on your head or something. You die violently. No, I think cut off means execute them legally through the courts. And Adam Clark says there are 36 places in which this excision or cutting off is threatened against the Jews for neglect of some particular duty, and what is implied in the thing itself is not well known. So yeah, those scholars don't know exactly what cut off means, but the idea is that you better not eat leavened bread on the Feast of Unleavened Bread because you are violating God's holy commandment. We turn now to Exodus chapter 12, verses 16 through 20. On the first day, you shall have a holy assembly. That's the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And this is God continuing to instruct Aaron and Moses how they should instruct the Hebrews. On the first day, you shall have a holy assembly and another holy assembly on the seventh day. No work at all shall be done on them except what must be eaten by every person that alone may be prepared by you. You shall also observe the Feast of Unleavened Bread, for on this very day I brought your host out of the land of Egypt. Therefore you shall observe this day throughout your generations as a permanent ordinance. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at evening, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at evening. 7 days there shall be no leaven found in your houses, for whoever eats what is leavened, that person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is an alien or a native of the land. You shall not eat anything leavened in all your dwellings. You shall eat unleavened bread. Now, why is the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread marked as a holy assembly, as we read in verse 16? Because that's the first day that Israel left Egypt. They ate the Passover at night. The next day, off they went. Verse 17 says, on this very day, I brought your host out of the land of Egypt. That's the very first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, 15th of Nisan. Now, the first day and the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread was to be holy. That meant that no work was to be done, so it is a Sabbath day. Now, it's not quite a Sabbath. It's not a strict Sabbath as the weekly Sabbath, because the weekly Sabbath, you couldn't do any work. But on this Sabbath, it says, except what must be eaten by every person, that alone may be prepared for you. You could cook on this Feast of Unleavened Bread Sabbath, first and seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is a little bit different than the weekly Sabbath where you couldn't cook at all. But basically, it's a Sabbath day, a holy day, no work except for that cooking of the food. It was also to be a holy assembly or a holy convocation. Adam Clark says this is the first place stated of an assembly merely for religious worship. I'm assuming that's of the Jews. First place that they gathered together for religious worship. All their ceremonies were done in the houses before then. So the Passover was celebrated in homes. The Feast of Unleavened Bread was celebrated in an assembly. Now the seventh day is also marked as holy. Seventh day of Unleavened Bread, which is the 21st of Nisan. Why is that marked as holy? John Gill says it's because that's the day that Pharaoh and his host were drowned in the Red Sea. I can't find any other commentators to back Gill up on that. I don't believe that's the reason. I suspect that it's a holy day merely because it's 7 days after the first holy assembly. And as we know, seven is the holy number. It's everywhere in the Old Testament scriptures, in the book of Revelation. And so we got a seventh day. It's basically a festival Sabbath, we'll say, to distinguish it from a weekly Sabbath. And as weekly Sabbaths are holy, so are festival Sabbaths. We know that a regular Sabbath day there was no work to be done at all, including cooking, Exodus 16:23. Then he said to them, "This is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until the morning." In other words, cook your food the day before. You don't cook it on the Sabbath. But on the festival Sabbath, the Feast of Unleavened Bread Sabbath, you could cook on those Sabbath days. Now, the 21st day is the seventh day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The KJV has the 20th. The NIV has the 21st. The NASB has the 21st. That illustrates how complex it is to get the date straight. Here's what I'm assuming. The 14th day at evening in our passage here, that's Exodus 12, 18. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at evening, that's talking about the preparation of the Passover lamb. Then when evening falls, it's the 15th of Nisan, and that's when they ate the lamb, and that's when they started the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so I'm going to count them out for you. Nisan 15, day 1. Nisan 16, day 2. Nisan 17, day 3. Nisan 18, day 4. Nisan 19, day 5. Nisan 20, day 6. Nisan 21, day 7. So there you have it. Nisan 15, Nisan 21 are the two Sabbaths bookending the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Notice in verse 19 that an alien or a native of the land eats unleavened bread, he's going to be cut off. Doesn't matter whether you are an alien or not. So I don't know why there would be aliens in the land of Goshen with the Hebrews, but apparently there were of some sort. We go now to Exodus 12, verses 21 through 23. Then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go and take for yourselves lambs according to your families, and slay the Passover lamb. You shall take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood which is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and the two doorposts. And none of you shall go outside the door of his house until morning, for the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to come into your houses to smite you." That's New American Standard Version. It sounds like King James, that smiting. I'm sure the ESV and the Holman Christian Study Bible modernize it a little bit, but I like it. God's not going to smite you. So now God has finished talking to Moses and Aaron. Now in verse 21, Moses actually goes out and gets all the elders of Israel. Who are the elders? Well, it could be heads of the tribes, heads of families. There were 12 tribes, and each tribe was broken down into families. He could have spoken just to those elders. John Gill says it actually could be elders of age, not elders of office. I don't believe that. Moses just talked to the old people? No, I don't think so. And then, of course, the elders of the tribes and families fanned out and told their subordinates what the deal was. So the Passover lamb here is finally slain in verse 21. Moses says, go out and slay it. Go do it. Slay the Passover lamb. 1 Corinthians 5:7, clean out the old leaven so that you may be a new lump, just as you are in fact unleavened. For Christ our Passover also has been sacrificed. Jesus is directly compared to a Passover lamb by the Apostle Paul. Now blood, which was drained from the lamb when it was slain into a basin, the blood was in the basin and picked up by hyssop, which was inserted into the blood. And then the hyssop branch was used to coat the doorpost and the lintel. The lintel is the material that stretches from doorpost to doorpost above your head as you go through the doorway. Hyssop goes onto the lintel, or hyssop puts the blood onto the lintel as well as the doorpost. What is hyssop? John Gill says it's probably an aromatic plant of the mint family with a straight stalk and white flowers. Actually, that's NIV Study Bible says this. Although John Gill says it's uncertain whether the Hebrew word actually meant hyssop, but we're going to assume it does. White mint, white flowers, mint smell, that stands for purity. White stands for purity. The NIV Study Bible says its hairy leaves allowed it to hold water well and make a good sprinkling device. It was used for many purification rituals in the Mosaic Law. Adam Clark says it had an aromatic smell, and a pungent taste. Now, the Israelites were told not to go outside. None of you shall go outside. Why? Because if you go outside, you won't be under the blood, and the angel of the destroyer, the destroying angel, will come and wipe you out. So stay inside to avoid the destroyer. Now, who is the destroyer that's coming? Here's three options. Option one, it could be a band of destroying angels. We get that from Psalm 78, verse 49. He sent upon them, that's God, sent upon them his burning anger, fury, and indignation, and trouble, a band of destroying angels. Well, that's assuming that Psalms is referring here to the Passover. And that might be too precise. Psalm 78 might be referring to all the earlier nine plagues. Destroying angels could have done that. So it's not necessarily a band of destroying angels during the Passover. So I think that's weak. John Gill says it could be a good angel. John Gill says it would seem much more appropriate than a bad angel to administer the justice of God. And I think he's right about that. So I'm assuming it's a good angel, the angel of death. John Gill says some people speculate it's a bad angel, but he says whether it's good or bad, it doesn't matter. Death was wrought upon the land of Egypt. We go now to Exodus 12, verses 24 through 28, and we'll finish up this audio. And you shall observe this event as an ordinance for you and your children forever. That's Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. This is Moses telling the people. Now, this is not God telling Moses. Moses is telling the people. When you enter the land which the Lord will give you, that's the promised land, as he has promised you, the promised land, you shall observe this rite of Passover and Feast of Unleavened Bread. And when your children say to you, what does this rite mean to you? You shall say, it is a Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the sons of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians, but spared our homes. And the people bowed low and worshiped. Then the sons of Israel went and did so, just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. In other words, they went and slayed the Passover lamb, got ready for the Passover meal. Now, Moses tell them to observe this event as an ordinance forever, and it was, but not every detail of the first Passover was carried over to later ones, as John Gill points out. For example, sprinkling of the blood on the doorpost, that wasn't carried out. I'm not that familiar with the development of the Passover feast to know which other ones were not carried out, but this is loosely speaking. It's just the Passover in general is carried out forever and ever, not every little detail of it. Now it's carried out forever. The NIV says it's carried out as a lasting ordinance. Now remember, forever can also, in the Hebrew, I think it's olam, it can be translated for a long time, not necessarily forever and ever and ever and ever. It can just mean for a long time. In other words, it doesn't mean eternally forever. And as a matter of fact, the Jews quit killing the Passover lamb after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And so, obviously, the ordinance did not last forever eternal in the eternal sense. It lasted forever. As long as Israel was a nation, it lasted. It lasted for a long time, but it did not last eternally. Notice that Moses refers to the land that they're about to enter at the end of the Exodus as the land that God has promised you. That's the so-called promised land. Remember, the land promise was one of the three basic promises that God gave Abraham. I'm quoting from memory here. Exodus 12, when Abraham went into the promised land, into Shechem as he left Haran. That's Exodus 12 and Exodus, excuse me, Genesis 12 and Genesis 15, when the covenant was created between Abram and Yahweh, the land was promised. And we see it also in 17 and chapter 22. At least we see these three promises, the land, offspring, and blessing promises made, maybe not in every detail in every passage there, but this is all through the book of Genesis is extremely important. I've got a table somewhere in my notes where it shows where every last promise is made of land, offspring, and blessing. So this is the promised land. Moses is already being referring to it as the promised land, hearkening back to the promises to Abraham. The sense of history the people of Israel had is very deep. And the sense of history is reinforced by this Passover rite because your children are going to say, what does this mean? Now, they still do that today in modern Passovers. The youngest child asks similar questions like this. What does this mean? In Exodus 13, 14, we read this. And it shall be when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is this? Then you shall say to him, with a powerful hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. The details of the Passover would be so unusual that it would be natural for a kid to ask, what is this? Now, Moses refers to the Passover as this rite, R-I-T-E, rite, in verse 26. Here's some examples of the aspects of the Passover ritual. Killing and roasting of a lamb, that stands for Jesus, the Passover lamb. The blood being put on the post, gold on the doorpost and the lintels, his blood defending us from death. Eating the lamb with bitter herbs, the bitter herbs referring to the bitter slavery of the Egyptians. Abstaining from leavened bread, that shows how hasty they had to leave. Eating with their loin cloths tucked into their belts, with sandals on their feet, showing the haste. All that stuff is ritual symbolism to help the people remember. The people accepted this because in verse 27, they bowed low in worship. That indicated the people's complete acceptance of the Passover ordinance. And ladies and gentlemen, with that, we have finished with the institution of the Passover. We'll take up the end of Exodus 12 in our next audio, and we will see the death of the firstborn inflicted by the angel of death. I hope you stay tuned for that audio and hope you enjoy this one.